Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ramzi Kaisiya of the Free Gaza Movement, who reviews the tragic events resulting from the Israeli attack on the six-boat aid flotilla bound for Gaza, and the reason human rights groups are challenging Israel's blockade of Gaza. Wilma Subra, a chemist and consultant to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, who considers the long-term environmental and economic impact of the massive British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And Christopher Hellman of the National Priorities Project, who talks about the meaning of $1 trillion now being spent on the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan versus funding programs that address human needs. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Former MIT student and political activist Lori Helene Berenson was granted parole by a Peruvian judge on Tuesday, May 25th. Berenson left the prison after having served 15 years of a 20-year sentence and after being convicted of aiding the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, or MRTA. Berenson had for many years denied any wrongdoing, maintaining she was a political prisoner and not a terrorist. Berenson was arrested in 1995 while in the company of the MRTA leader's wife for allegedly assisting in a plot to take over Peru's Congress. Then in 1996, Berenson, a New York resident, was convicted of treason by an anonymous military court and was sentenced to life in prison. But after an intense appeals campaign by her parents to the U.S. State Department, Berenson was retried in a civilian court in 2001 and found guilty of the lesser crime of terrorist collaboration, and she was sentenced to 20 years. Berenson is now 40 years old and the mother of a one-year-old son with soon-to-be ex-husband and lawyer Anibal Apari, whom she met in prison. Apari also served time for his involvement with the MRTA. Berenson must remain in Lima until 2015 to serve out her parole, after which time she may be expelled from the country. However, Peru's cabinet chief, Javier Velasquez, stated that a meeting of the ministers would decide whether to commute the sentence and deport Berenson sooner. A date has not been set when the cabinet might meet. A four-week undercover investigation that began in April and was carried out by the animal rights group Mercy for Animals, which is based in Chicago, has led to the arrest of 25-year-old Delaware resident Billy Joe Gregg Jr. The group released graphic video footage showing Gregg and others beating cows with pitchforks in the face, legs, and stomach, maliciously beating restrained cows in the face with crowbars, body slamming them to the ground, breaking their tails, punching cows' udders, and bragging about stabbing, shooting, and beating newborn calves to death. The abuse took place on the Conklin Dairy Farms in Plain City, Ohio, which is federally subsidized. Although farm owner Gary Conklin stated he would fire any of his employees who willfully abused the animals, the footage revealed Conklin himself viciously kicking a cow in the face, head, and neck. Gregg is being held on $100,000 bail and faces 12 counts of cruelty to animals. Penalties could result in a $750 fine and 60 days in jail for each count. Gregg asked the judge for leniency, saying he is a disabled veteran of the U.S. Army who had served 6 years. Gregg also said he is studying to be a police officer and needed to take care of his dogs. Ohioans and others are currently pushing to pass HB 55, known as the Animal Cruelty and Pet Protection Bill, which will encourage judges to include pets in domestic abuse protective orders. The bill also emphasizes the need to counsel convicted animal abusers and strengthens misdemeanor penalties for intentional torture of livestock and wildlife. A year after getting bailed out by the American taxpayer, big banks on Wall Street have boosted perks for high-flying CEOs, including covering the cost of country club dues, chauffeured drivers, and home security systems. According to the Washington Post, J.P. Morgan Chase has granted CEO Jamie Dimon $91,000 in personal travel expenses in a company jet during 2009, up from $54,000 the previous year. Diamond's personal perks totaled over $226,000 last year. Although many blue-chip companies reduced corporate benefits during the recession, big banks have boosted their overall benefits for CEOs. Advocates for more responsible corporate governance say the money set aside for CEO perks could be better used to raise the dividend for shareholders or be reinvested in core operations of the company. The financial reform bill in Congress, now in a conference committee, contains a provision to give shareholders an advisory up or down vote on executive compensation packages. In addition, the Obama administration's pay czar, Kenneth Feinberg, who has criticized big perks for CEOs, is now reviewing the pay practices of the 400 financial services companies that received aid through the federal government's TARP program. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
An Israeli military assault on a flotilla of civilian ships in international waters carrying 10,000 tons of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian population of Gaza resulted in at least 9 dead, dozens injured, and an international firestorm of protest. While the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs claimed that during the interception of the ships, the demonstrators on board attacked the IDF naval personnel with live fire and light weaponry, including knives and clubs, passengers on board tell a different story. Survivors of the attack told Free Gaza, one of the groups that organized the flotilla, that Israeli troops who boarded the Turkish flagship Mavi Marmara, the site of the worst violence and all of the fatalities, rappelled down ropes from helicopters onto the ship and began to shoot the moment their feet hit the deck. The 700 passengers from 40 nations aboard the seized ships, which included a Nobel Peace laureate, parliamentarians, and former U.S. diplomats, were brought to the Israeli port of Ashdod, where they were questioned and had cameras, laptops, cell phones, and even clothes confiscated. In reaction to the Israeli attack, protests erupted across the world. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, where 4 of the 9 killed were from, accused Israel of state terrorism and withdrew its ambassador to Israel. The United Nations Security Council condemned the attack and demanded an impartial investigation into the naval assault. Leaders of the Free Gaza movement vowed to send another cargo ship to Gaza in the coming days. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ramzi Kaisia, an organizer with the Free Gaza movement, who reviews the tragic events resulting from the Israeli attack and the reason human rights groups are challenging Israel's Gaza blockade enforced since June 2007.
Well, we were last in touch with our ships just before the attack began. They reported that they had been surrounded by Israeli ships and that they thought that maybe the Israelis were going to go ahead and try and take them there in international waters rather than wait for them to approach Gaza. Our communications were cut at that time, but there was a live satellite feed from the largest passenger ship, the Turkish ship, representing the Human Rights and Humanitarian Relief Foundation in Turkey. That continued for several more minutes, and there were a number of international journalists aboard that ship who were reporting. What they stated was that Israeli commandos rappelled down from helicopters firing at the passengers as they came onto the ship, that they had killed one, possibly two people at that time. The organizers aboard the ship immediately called all the passengers to go inside the ship, to sit down, to make sure that they did nothing that would be interpreted as threatening. They raised a white flag on the ship, and at this point, some of the passengers began to physically defend themselves against the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli soldiers continued to open fire. All of the ships were taken. We had 3 passenger ships and 3 cargo ships on this flotilla, carrying 700 passengers from 40 different countries, humanitarian aid workers, human rights workers, members of parliament, international journalists, and 10,000 tons of humanitarian and developmental aid. The ships were towed to the port of Ashdod in southern Israel. The passengers were offloaded and placed in a temporary detention camp that the Israelis have been constructing for the last couple of weeks around the port.
Ramzi, can you respond to statements by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the Israeli commandos were attacked by those on board the ships with clubs, knives, and even live fire that caused them to shoot and kill 9 of the passengers? And also, if you would, place in context some of the videos that are being broadcast in our media that shows some of those protesters striking the Israeli commandos with poles.
If this had actually been a case of aggression against any of those soldiers, as blatant as what they are saying, then I think that is something that would have immediately been transmitted and wouldn't have waited so many hours before the Israeli government started putting this forward as their theory of what happened. But, I mean, it's ridiculous. The passengers aboard these ships are well-known human rights humanitarian aid workers. Everyone went through nonviolence training. We take a pledge of nonviolence. We insisted that port authorities at every port that the ships left from, and the different ships left from different ports in the Eastern Mediterranean, but that at every port, the port authorities searched the ships, searched the cargo to make sure that there were no weapons on board, because we knew that this is going to be the propaganda from the Israeli government. And we wanted to make sure that we had a strong counter to that. Now, the notion that Israeli soldiers, IDF soldiers from the most highly trained military in the world, the fourth most powerful military in the world, folks who had been handpicked for this mission, who had been training for weeks for this mission, that they had somehow not planned for the possibility of how are we going to take this ship with hundreds of people aboard, that they're firing stun grenades and tear gas and indeed live ammunition as they came down onto these ships was not going to terrorize people and cause them to fear for their lives. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I fear that what happened this morning was a cold calculation by the Israeli government to try and to frighten off any future attempts to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza.
Ramzi, as we conclude, please tell our listeners about the central mission of your organization to get humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza and why that's so important to challenge this blockade.
Well, for a little over 4 years now, the Israeli government has subjected the people of Gaza to an increasingly severe blockade. Today, this means that less than 20% of the supplies that are normally needed for trade in Gaza are actually allowed in. Gaza is a tiny little place. It's 25 miles long by 4 to 7 miles wide, with 1.5 million people living there, half of them children. It's one of the most densely populated places on the planet, and it does not have the physical resources to be able to provide and support the population that is living there. Two-thirds of them, themselves refugees from the 1948 founding war of Israel, people who had lived in Haifa, in Yaffa, in towns in the north, what is now Israel, and who were forced out and forced to settle in Gaza. It's become the world's largest open-air prison. And the consequences of that are, as you may predict, every UN agency working in Gaza, every international aid agency working in Gaza has thoroughly documented the devastating effects of this blockade, serious increases in childhood malnutrition, massive increases in poverty. 95% of Gaza's native industries have been forced to close because they cannot get the necessary materials to continue to operate. Electricity is only sporadic. Spare parts for the repair of machinery, maintenance of machinery, cannot come in. So you have a population that has been subjected to this increasingly severe weight, this increasingly severe deprivation. And it was our intention to say that collective punishment is an act that is illegal under international law and that is profoundly immoral. And if the international community will not itself implement and force Israel to hold to the international standards, then I think it becomes incumbent on us as private citizens, as people of conscience, to stand up and say, no, this cannot continue, not in our name. We will take direct, nonviolent action in order to violate this unjust blockade and bring some hope to the people of Gaza.
That was Ramzi Kaizia of the Free Gaza Movement. Contact the group's U.S. office at area code 510-232-2500 or visit their website at freegaza.org. 6 weeks after the explosion and sinking of the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, no substantive progress has been made in stopping the oil that's gushing from a mile below the surface waters of the Gulf of Mexico. The top kill method, the latest maneuver employed by British Petroleum to stop the leak, failed. According to many scientists and environmentalists, the oil, along with the toxic dispersants that have been used to break up the spill, have polluted the water column, descending to the seabed where bottom-residing organisms such as shrimp, crabs, and oysters are found. The spill has also fouled Louisiana's shoreline estuaries and threatens the coasts of neighboring states. BP's oil blowout, the largest in U.S. history, has already had a severe environmental and economic impact on one of the richest fisheries in the continental U.S., which supplies one-third of the seafood consumed by Americans. Wilma Subra is a Louisiana chemist and founder of the Subra Company, a chemistry lab and environmental consulting firm that provides technical support to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. She is a past recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship grant, the so-called Genius Award. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Subra, who discusses her concerns about the toxicity of the oil and dispersants on people exposed to them during the cleanup, as well as the long-term impact of the oil spill on the environment.
Well, we've been involved in a lot of discussions about the material safety data sheet and the proprietary restrictions on them. And we are particularly concerned when someone gets injured and are just taken to the hospital, and yet the medical profession that has to deal with them doesn't know what chemicals they have been in contact with. And we've been pushing, if you can't release it to everyone, you need to be able to release it immediately to the medical staff and the emergency responders that are having to deal with this.
And they have not done that yet?
No, they haven't done that yet.
Well, Ms. Subra, is this leak, which is still gushing as much as ever from the wellhead, likely to permanently destroy the fisheries in the Gulf, or do you think the ecosystem can recover?
Well, that's a big issue because of the application of the dispersant and it's spread throughout the water column and the sediment as well as on the surface, and it is getting into the marshy areas. The destruction of the ecosystem is really critical, and the time frame it would take to come back is really hard to estimate at this point because a lot of these chemicals that are in the crude oil are and in the dispersant bioaccumulate up the food chain. So even after it destroys the ecosystem, when populations start trying to come back, they will actually build these chemicals up in their body and it magnifies up the food chain. So this will have a very, very long-lasting impact both in the wetlands and to the fisheries resources, as well as the chemicals in the crude oil and the chemicals in the dispersants, particularly those in the crude oil, are known and suspected to cause cancer, so that the anticipated long-term impacts of people that have actually been exposed to it, which include the fishers who are not being provided with respirators, but are out there over the slick, fooling with the booms and the pads that are full of the crude oil, it looks like they will also have very long-term health impacts as a result of working to try and protect the marshland.
They are not being provided respirators by BP?
The fishermen are not being provided the respirators. We went to court on May 7th and charged that BP was not providing the people who were going to respond, which include a lot of the fishers, with the appropriate training and with the appropriate protective gear. We won that. BP still continued not to provide them with enough protective gear and not with respirators. Then we went to EPA, and with EPA we went to NOAA. NOAA came out weekend before last with a directive on exactly what kind of training for what jobs and requiring BP to provide the protective gear, including the respirators. That still has not happened. And working with Louisiana Environmental Action Network over this whole incident, we immediately ordered protective gear and respirators and got it down to the fishing community who was so desperate for it. And what we're hearing is that if they wear a respirator out in the field, BP tells them to get off the job. And they are being severely impacted. They come in with the severe headaches, with the nausea, with the respiratory impacts on a daily basis. We've notified the federal agencies that this is going on and hope that the federal agencies will take the appropriate action.
How are people in the community responding to this?
Well, we're very frustrated, and the people in the community are very frustrated. But the fishers and their families are also very reluctant to speak out because right now, the fishing grounds are closed, so the fishers cannot go out and earn a living. So the best they can do is work for BP and try and protect their marshes that are their resource of the future. And so they're very reluctant to speak out because they're scared when they go back to the job in the morning, they're going to be told, you no longer have a job, and then they have absolutely no source of income.
How would you compare the Katrina disaster of 2005 to this disaster for people in Louisiana?
Well, when you talk to the fishermen down there, they said after Katrina, we could start building. We knew it was over, and we could start trying to build back up. And in this case, we can't because everything's contaminated. And as the oil moves into the marshy areas and starts to kill off the vegetation, then the prospects of even greater coastal erosion will come along because the vegetation is what holds the soil and sediment together. And so when you talk to the fishermen, they go, right, as bad as Katrina was, it's nothing compared to this.
That was Wilma Subra, an advisor to the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. For updated information on the leak and its impact on local communities, call the network at area code 228-928-1315 or visit the group's website at leanweb.org. On Memorial Day 2010, Americans honored the service of the hundreds of thousands of men and women who have fought in the nation's wars, past and present. During this year's holiday, parades and ceremonies remembered those who have fallen in the wars that continue in Iraq and Afghanistan. To date, more than 4,400 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq, and more than 1,000 have been killed in Afghanistan. Servicemen and women who have been injured in these conflicts number in the tens of thousands. In addition to the human cost of these wars, America's funding for the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have now exceeded the $1 trillion mark as of May 30th, according to the group National Priorities Project, which tracks U.S. military spending. That trillion-dollar figure includes $747.3 billion appropriated for the war in Iraq and $299 billion for the war in Afghanistan. A supplemental spending bill for both wars, now pending in Congress, would allocate an additional $37 billion, added to the $136.8 billion for the current fiscal year. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Christopher Hellman, communications liaison with the National Priorities Project, who talks about the meaning of $1 trillion spent on war versus funding programs that address human needs. He describes what other priorities these dollars could have funded if they were applied to social programs at home, such as education, health care, public safety, energy efficiency, and affordable housing.
Well, one of the things that we do at NPP is we attempt to take these really incredibly large and sort of somewhat daunting numbers and put them in some context. One of the things that we're able to do, for instance, is divide up based on population the share of that money that each state is responsible for. And we can break it down even further than that. We can break it down into that below the state level down to cities and towns. And then we provide what we call our trade-off page, which takes those numbers. And we provide information on what types of other federal programs might benefit from that spending if it wasn't going to the war, and how many of those types of things you can provide. So, you know, Head Start program slots, renewable energy, college scholarships. We just try to put into context what are really very large numbers and give people something to compare to in the context of other things that the federal government does on their behalf.
Your group has drawn up some of the comparisons of what it costs, for instance, to build a school or hire a teacher or build a hospital with what we're spending in similar dollar amounts to the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things that you find is that people really don't have a good grasp of the relative value of what it is we spend, how far $1 trillion would take you or $1 billion would take you. And so we think it's important to present other examples of how that money might be spent so you get a feel for the kind of magnitude of the money that we're talking about. Because, for instance, we're going to spend this year, we're going to spend about $170 billion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan just this current year. Okay, now that you know that, what does that mean to you? Well, it might mean something to you if you know that would provide Pell Grants, the maximum Pell Grant award for every college and university student in this country. when you look at the Medicare program, which is the health care program for the uninsured, $1 trillion would supply health care for 1 year for almost 300 million people through that. You could create almost 8 million affordable housing units. You could provide another 16.5 million elementary school teachers for 1 year. You're not going to necessarily need 16 million teachers. So what these things really do is just sort of give you an order of magnitude of how much investment we're talking about.
Now, when we talk about the process that delivers this money to the U.S. military and the role of the president and the White House, what kinds of information are you trying to arm citizens with in terms of having dialogue with the representatives in Washington when these votes are taken and these hundreds of billion dollars are allocated?
Well, one of the things we think is important for people to be able to say to elected officials is, this is what it's costing your constituents to do this. And by the way, you know, particularly in times right now where states and cities are really suffering, and the amount of federal money flowing into these communities is dwindling, wouldn't it be useful to have, you know, maybe have some more of this money available? And a lot of times elected officials themselves are unaware of, particularly, you know, ones who haven't been in Washington all that long, aren't aware of the importance of federal investment in their state. So we think that by providing people with these kind of tools, they can make, you know, a pretty significant argument when they meet with the elected officials. Now, obviously, you know, the decisions about going to war and ending wars are not purely fiscal. There are other considerations, obviously, and some that are considerably more important. But the truth is that these kinds of numbers are of intense interest to people. Our counters are embedded in literally hundreds of websites around the world, and we register between 2.5 and 3 million hits a month. So people are paying very close attention to this, and I think recognize the impact that this allocation of resources to military operations has on the other things that they might be asking their government to do.
That was Christopher Hellman, communications liaison with the National Priorities Project. Contact the project by calling area code 413-584-9556. Or visit their website at nationalpriorities.org to find out what programs your tax dollars fund. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.